There are two molecules. There are two molecules I'd like to discuss today. One of them you have, of course, seen before, benzene. The other of them, what would look like to be a smaller cousin, cyclobutadiene. They are both cyclic systems. They are both systems in which each carbon is sp2 hybridized, but they're very different in their behavior. Cyclobutadiene, I'll start with the description of it first. Can only be isolated at sub-zero temperatures. And is extremely reactive if you can isolate it. You might remember us discussing conjugation in the linear butadiene case. And in that case, we talked about how the single bond that's between the two double bonds ends up shorter than your average single bond would. And that was part of the evidence that there is conjugation. The exact opposite happens in cyclobutadiene. The single bond, either of those two single bonds, is in fact stretched compared to a normal single bond. So much so that that's why the compound can only be isolated at extremely cold temperatures. You have to remove enough energy from the system that heat itself doesn't pull the molecule apart. So the single bonds, which they are single bonds. See, that's part of the difference between this system and the linear system, where there we could say there's this, yeah, there's really a single bond there, but there's a lot of interaction between the pi bonds. Here the pi bonds are trying not to interact, and we'll discover why momentarily. So the single bonds are unusually long and weak. Everything is opposite with benzene. Benzene can very easily be isolated at any temperature, pretty much, except maybe extraordinarily high temperatures. The benzene does not react the way that a normal alkene would. So benzene does not react with a normal acid like HBr. It won't react with borane the same way that alkenes would. It won't react with the mercury acetate in oxymercuration, demercuration. It will react with bromine, but not in this type of mechanism that you've seen before. So even though we write the structure of benzene with double bonds, it doesn't act like it's a compound that has double bonds. And in fact, the single bonds here are much like what you'd see in the linear butadiene case. Even more so, instead of there being just shortened single bonds, really between any of the carbon-carbon bonds, there's no difference. So there really isn't a single versus a double bond in that compound. They're all equal in length and therefore equal in reactivity. So there's something going on by making these systems cyclic that's unusual. And let me write down what I said about benzene before I continue that thought, though. So benzene is easily isolated across a range of temperatures. And it can only react with strong electrophiles or nucleophiles. So those are both opposite the behavior of cyclobutadiene. And there is no difference between any of the carbon-carbon bonds in benzene. All the bonds are between a single and double bond in length. And what we're going to be getting into today is the topic of aromaticity. So you'll see this word aromatic, which in English, aroma means smell, of course, and aromatic is related to the fact that a lot of benzene and benzene derivatives do have a very noticeable fragrance to them. But aromatic, the term, does not just have something to do with the smell. By it being associated with benzene, it refers to this really extraordinary stabilization that can occur when you take a pi system like what benzene has and wrap it around in a circle. If you notice, every position on that benzene ring is sp2 hybridized, which means every carbon in that ring interacts with each other. In the case of benzene, that ends up being favorable, and that high favorability is what we call aromaticity. To do that for cyclobutadiene, though, makes it incredibly unstable. And it's not the fact that it's a four-membered ring. If I only had one double bond in that compound, cyclobutene, that is isolatable. Still reactive, but very isolatable. But for some reason, making a system where you had four carbons only that are all overlapping in the same way of benzene, it makes it a worse compound than if it had just been uncyclized to begin with. So there's some kind of destabilization that occurs, and we're going to call that anti-aromaticity. And in fact, that's where we're going to start, because just like we drew molecular orbital diagrams where we used p orbitals to try to represent bonds and antibonds, it's simpler to do that with a four-carbon system than a six-carbon system. So we're going to start with the negative potential effect of cyclization first. And this is all so that we can start doing benzene chemistry. But before we get to what benzene does, we need to talk about the molecular orbital description. I know I've given you an introduction, and there's lots and lots of detail that we need to fill in, but any questions at this point before I launch into a description of cyclobutadiene? Well, then let's go back very, very briefly to the discussion that we had about the particle in the box the other day, which I know most of you have never seen that example before, but the point of giving that example was that it was a thought problem that's very similar, or gives very similar solutions to what we saw in that phone cord demonstration. Which, if you remember, both of those were ways of trying to model what happens in one of these pi systems, where you've got carbon after carbon after carbon that are all connected to each other like they're in a line. And these molecular orbitals that those pi electrons go into, they cover across that line and have the ends of the lines as the end points, which matches what happens in that wiggling phone cord, which matches what happens in the particle-in-the-box problem. The point of mentioning that again is to look at what the shapes of the waves generated are and notice something about the symmetry of those waves. So just as a reminder, we get something like this, that the lowest energy wave evenly spans across the whole system. The next highest energy wave has one and exactly one node, and it causes the wave to have an inflection. Or not flexion, it crosses the axis in the middle. But one half, other than the fact that one half is up and down, they're otherwise symmetric. There is a third level where it evenly splits the system into three parts. So in other words, for zero nodes, the wave just starts and ends from one side to the other. If you have one node, it's exactly in the middle. If you have two nodes, they cut it exactly in thirds. If you kept on going, each wave that's generated has a symmetry where all the nodes cut the system into equal parts. There is a similar restriction on symmetry once we have a cyclic system of p orbitals. Boy, that almost turns into she sells seashells at the seashore. So in one of these cyclic systems, one of the requirements of symmetry is that a node must pass all the way through the center of the ring. And that if you have multiple nodes, they all pass through the center of the ring. There's no easy way to prove that. That's just one of those things you'll have to accept unless you take more advanced physical or quantum mechanics. But let's see how that changes or influences the type of molecular orbitals that we're going to end up with. Because I guess it would be useful to do this once, that if we have a molecule like cyclobutadiene, just to prove to ourselves that there's something unusual going on, let's draw a smog first. This is one of those pictures where we're not shading in p orbitals. We're showing all the different orbitals that exist. And if in this case, each of those carbons is sp2 hybridized. So we'll end up with something like this. So there's our 4 sp2 hybridized carbons. There are, of course, hydrogens on each of those positions. And then we have p orbitals. Which again, in one of these diagrams, I'm not showing any shading of the p orbital. Again, I'm just showing types of orbitals. And the right-hand side's not quite clear enough, but it's a copy of what's on the left-hand side there. All of the p orbitals overlap with each other in theory, because all of them would be potentially close to each other that they should overlap. But I've already told you that in real life, this is a structure that's distorted, where the two double bonds are trying to pull away from each other. So there's not an equivalence across the structure, and that's what we need to now discuss why. Now, in the linear system, when we had something like the allyl carbocation, there were three atoms involved, so we had three molecular orbitals. When we got to the 1,3-butadiene, there were four atoms involved, so we had four molecular orbitals. Same thing here. We're going to have four p orbitals, four atoms involved. So once you delocalize, that makes four molecular orbitals. Let's see if we can rationalize what the representation of those four orbitals is going to look like. So in real life, we got the four orbitals, and they happen no matter how we describe it. Then we describe it, though, by using this picture and taking those p orbitals and shading them in a way that makes something that looks like the real molecular orbitals. Well, what way of shading the p orbitals would be the most energetically favorable possibility? Because one other thing to refer back to that particle in the box or the phone core demonstration is there is one and only one lowest energy level. So what would that look like for the cyclobutadiene system in terms of shading in p orbitals?
When they're all in phase.
When they're all in phase, which means they're all shaded exactly the same way. So here's an energy level, and then here's our orbital description of it. And this would be a case where we have no nodes, which is also generally the case for the lowest energy system. It's one that does not have any nodes in it. What would be the absolute worst case scenario in terms of using shading? Every other one is opposite each other, correct? Which in an even numbered system like this, only four atoms, you can do that easily.
So here I will shade every other one.
How many nodes does the system therefore have?
Four.
What if I remind us that the node must pass exactly through the middle of the molecule, which this is one of those things that just happens when you have cyclic symmetry. For one node, it has to pass through the middle of the molecule. Well, you're saying there's just one node? Five. You can't have five nodes if you've only got four atoms. Well, a node has to occur between atoms, right? Well, let's see. If I draw one node, you know, that one node I've drawn makes the two halves opposite each other, which is exactly what's going on. But then the two halves also have an opposition within themselves. So if I draw another node like this, now I've got all of the flips between signs accounted for. There are only two nodes in the system. Why am I making a big deal out of this? Because there is no such thing as 1.5 nodes or 3.25. The nodes are always whole numbers, and they're always 0 or greater. Well, if I have 0 and I have 2 and I have 2 more molecular orbitals, then how many nodes are going to be in those 2 molecular orbitals? Oh, take the easy bait, people. If you have 0 nodes, and if you have 2 nodes, and 2's the maximum and 0's the minimum, and there's only one way to do the 2 and there's only one way to do the 0, then how many nodes must be left in the other orbitals? 1. You are having a case of the Monday exams, aren't you? Important thing about there only being one node is that this is going to generate what are called degenerate, which means equal energy orbitals. So what will this look like? Well, one way we could cut through a system with just one node is to do just that. Put one node between the two pairs of atoms. Well, so that means 1/2 will be colored one way, 1/2 will be colored the other. That means that we'll have 2 favorable interactions, we'll have 2 unfavorable interactions. The number of favorable equal the number of unfavorable. So what kind of orbital do you think I just made? Energetically. A non-bonding orbital. The one where every other sign is opposite, what kind of orbital do you think that is? Antibonding. And then the one down here where everything is lined up the same way is going to be bonding. I'm going to redraw an energy diagram in a moment to put those labels on there. But before we do that, let's finish up with the last drawing of the molecular orbitals. Now, we've already had one way that I've cut through with just one node. Another one of these things you just have to believe is that another level of symmetry that occurs is that nodes have to be mathematically orthogonal to each other, which doesn't always mean 90 degrees. But that's another story for another day. But in this case, the only way to generate something that doesn't look like this orbital at all is to have the node cut instead through the atoms themselves. Now, wherever the node cuts through, that means the value of the function is 0. If we're trying to represent this function using p orbitals, we're not even going to use the p orbitals where the node cuts through. Because if the function is 0, why represent the function with anything that's not 0? So the fact that I'm not shading either side of them means they're not used at all. And actually, I would normally draw this picture leaving those p orbitals out. I drew them and then I thought, oh yeah, it's that one. Point of this is that the two p orbitals that are part of that representation are far enough apart that they don't interact with each other. So they're neither good nor bad, which means it's, again, a non-bonding orbital. You're liking my symbology, my very technical symbology there. So let's put this on an energy diagram. So zero means the energy of the atoms as if they had never been bound. And in this case, we are only talking about the pi system. We're ignoring what happens with the sigma bonds. We have the one orbital that's bonding, we have the one orbital that's antibonding, and the two orbitals that are non-bonding. How many pi electrons are there?
Four,
that's right. Because whether or not there really are double bonds there, because we're going to have that argument when we get to benzene, I'm going to say there aren't double bonds. But on paper, when we write it down, it does correctly account for the number of electrons that are there. So if we have two pi bonds that we're writing, that means there are four pi electrons, even if they're not really bonds, even if it is one of these delocalized systems. Well, what's the point of showing that we have four electrons? Well, they got to go somewhere. And Alfbau principle, the electrons go to the lowest energy level possible, so they're going to go into the bonding orbital. But Pauli exclusion principle, you can only fit two electrons in one orbital. So then the next electron by Alfbau principle has to go to the next energy level up. And since we didn't get to apply this before, because we have degenerate energy levels, two energy levels that are equal, then after we put one electron in one, the other electron that's left has to go into the other, which that'll have consequences we'll talk about later. But the most immediate consequence is if we calculate bond order. Because remember, bond order is number of bonding electrons minus number of antibonding electrons, that whole thing divided by 2. Well, we have 2 bonding electrons, we have no antibonding electrons, and notice the non-bonding electrons don't even get figured in here because they don't help and they don't hurt. They don't do anything. That's why they're called non-bonding. We end up with a bond order of 1 split across 4 atoms. Can 4 atoms be held together by 1 bond? No. And that's why this molecule is unstable. Now, why does the molecule try to pull apart then? What's the driving force for that to happen? Well, let's shift back a little bit and imagine that I have 2 molecules of ethene. 2 separate molecules of ethane. And because the symbology, because you might look at this and say, well, 4. if you're looking at this, or you might say 22. So let's say 2 molecules of ethene. Why does that matter? Well, because ethene has only a pi bond and a pi antibond to it. And if these are separate, they don't interact. So the 2 electrons that are in each of the bonding orbitals, I'm sorry, 2 of the electrons that are each shown in that pi bond, they only go into a bonding orbital. So the total bond order equals 2. So by taking the 2 double bonds and keeping them completely apart, the 4 pi electrons are able to all exist in bonding orbitals. As soon as you connect those p orbitals, you try to make a circle out of them, it changes the type of nodes that exist. It changes the system of molecular orbitals. And it creates a new set of orbitals in which electrons that used to be bonding have now been pushed up in energy into a non-bonding orbital. It's not favorable. So the molecule does what it can and tries to distort. The double bonds try to pull back apart because then the electrons start going more into a bonding orbital. But the single bond that connects them is only so strong, can only stretch so far. And the destabilization caused by pushing these electrons up into a non-bonding orbital is enough that it causes those single bonds to stretch enough that with a little heat, the whole thing just falls apart. That's the story of anti-aromaticity, and that's what anti-aromaticity is. An unusual destabilization of a pi system caused by the pi system being fully cyclically conjugated. So, cyclobutadiene, or even the butadiene system, and if we looked at the linear system,
let's use that as a comparison. These are not isomers, so you can't make a direct comparison, but the point still works in this case. When linear buta-1,3-diene is forced to cyclize, two bonding electrons are forced into higher energy non-bonding orbitals. Which is energetically unfavorable. To avoid this situation, the molecule attempts to distort. To prevent full cyclic conjugation. This is why cyclobutadiene is not a square and why it cannot be isolated at room temperature. Questions? I guess it's more just a lot to absorb in, but hopefully it's somewhat rational. And I've said it already, but to summarize it one more time to kind of get the point across. When we have the linear system, there's one set of nodes that are there. And then just work out the right way so you get two bonding and two antibonding orbitals. When you make it a circle, think of... there's no good physical equivalent. But think of this, that if you have some shape that's responsive to sound, imagine that you change the shape of that object, well, you're going to change what sounds it may respond to. If you have a wave that has to correctly overlap itself, because remember last quarter we talked about constructive and deconstructive interference. If you have a line, there's one set of restrictions of what waves can exist. When you make it a circle, you add an additional level of restrictions. That's what changes the node patterns. That's what changes the type of molecular orbitals that you've got. And in this case, this particular example with four atoms, you end up with a system where it's only got one bonding orbital, one antibonding orbital, and then two non-bonding orbitals. So going from the linear to the cyclic system, that's an increase of energy that must occur in order to get those bonding electrons into now non-bonding orbitals. For benzene, we're about to see the opposite happens, that if we looked at the linear system, it is actually more favorable to go into the cyclic system. Now, we have somehow, I did this far enough better today in here than the other section that we're kind of ahead of them. But that doesn't matter. We'll just plug on ahead. Since we have a little extra time, let's do it the same order. Let's see first the end answer, which is what do these molecular orbitals in benzene look like? So we have six carbons. We could draw a smog diagram, but really no need. It's similar to the cyclobutadiene, where you've got every carbon being sp2 hybridized, which means every p orbital interacts with every other p orbital, except they really do this time. And in fact, it's favorable for those p orbitals to interact, which is why all the bonds end up being the same length. If we have six atoms, that means we have six molecular orbitals. And we're again, just to make this a little shorter discussion, going to end up with only one case where you have the worst combo possible. Because since we have six atoms, you can go even, odd, or every other one, up and down, that gives us our highest energy orbital. Or our lowest energy orbital will again be the one where all the p orbitals that we use to represent it are in the same phase. So let's draw those two orbitals first. And if you think you even need to ask it, then you're not predicting well. The question I'm referring to is, do we need to be able to draw these? Why would I lead us all through this if I didn't expect you to be able to? So there's our highest energy, there's our lowest energy, and let me put zero right in the middle here. So, lowest energy system, I said, would be similar to what we saw in cyclobutadiene. And in fact, no matter how many carbons you've got, whether they're even or odd number even, you're always going to have the lowest energy orbital being the one where all orbitals used to represent it are shaded the same way. Since there's only one way you could do it with all of them shaded the same way, there is never more than one lowest orbital in these cyclic systems. The highest energy orbital is, again, the one where every other p orbital is shaded the opposite way. Remembering the example we saw earlier and remembering the restriction on nodes, how many nodes would there be in this highest energy orbital?
Three.
One, two, three. You see that I have zero nodes and three nodes. What must exist between?
One
and two. All right.
for reasons that even I don't know a way to do a hand-waving explanation of. In these cyclic systems, we'll never have more than two degenerate orbitals for any one level. We could have as many atoms as we want, and we'll end up with a whole bunch of orbitals, but we'll never end up with anything except more than... We'll never have a situation more than two have the same energy. Having said that, if I've got six total orbitals that I need, and I've only got two on paper so far, that means I've got four orbitals left, and you can't have more than two of the same energy, so that means we are going to have two and another two that are the same energy. We're going to have two pairs of molecular orbitals that are degenerate. Notice that I've already shown what the end result's going to be. That there are, in this case, no non-bonding orbitals. There's only bonding and anti-bonding. So even though I've drawn that zero line there, need to be very clear, there's no non-bonding orbitals. Now it just remains for us to draw our representations for these four remaining orbitals. Which I've done it again. I'll warn you in advance. I wasn't thinking, and I drew in pictures of all the p orbitals. But we're going to end up with at least one of these where a node passes through atoms again. And if it passes through the atoms, that means we're not even going to use that orbital. But let's build up slowly. So the one node system, there are two unique ways to do it. This one's the easier one to remember. One case, the node goes between atoms. Just like in the cyclobutadiene, one node goes through the atoms. The one where the node goes through I'm going to lightly cross out the p orbitals. And I'm going to say they're unused. Again, the reason being the node passes right through it, and so there's no value to the equation there. So there's no point in using a p orbital there. Yeah?
Well, I feel kind of confused. So in the middle of all those nodes, they intersect at the same point, right?
Yes, they do.
So then all these lines are like lines where the wave function is always zero, so the phase changes sign?
Along that line, that's correct.
So that's what we mean, really, by
a node is a place where the equation goes from being plus to being minus.
So it's zero right on
it's that. It's zero right on the node.
And that's why we have no bonding.
And that's why we have no p orbital being used there, yes. Now, on the one on the left, that means three of the p orbitals are going to be shaded one way. Oh, gosh. Anybody got white out? One of the few times you get to throw something at your instructor and get away with it. It's like, I missed my chance.
That's not hard.
I fail as a student, is that what you're saying? See, they didn't have paper and pencils back when I was a student, not that many years ago. Yeah, just imagine that back when I was a student, we didn't have... Well, we had the internet by the time I was in college, but of course we didn't have smartphones, iPads, Blackberries. Email I didn't get till I was a freshman, so... And now the 10-year-old kids I help with chemistry, they're all texting each other. But I know how to make a VCR not blink 12. Now notice this. These are two allyl interactions. So if you count up the total number of favorable versus unfavorable interactions, there's more favorable than unfavorable, and that's why it makes this a bonding orbital. In the cyclobutadiene case, because of the number of atoms involved, when we got to the one node case, the number of favorable and unfavorables were equal. So there is something to do with the number of atoms that are in the ring. And what we're going to find in the next lecture is there is a device, a concept, a way we can predict what the energies of the orbitals are, at least, without having to draw all these pictures out every time. We're doing it the long, painful way just for two cases, cyclobutadiene and benzene, because they're such classic cases in molecular orbital theory. Now let's look at the other one-node system here. So you have favorable interactions on either side, and the two sides are too far apart from each other for them to have an unfavorable interaction. So it's as if you had two isolated pi bonds, which are bonds, so that's a bonding orbital. Now let's get to the two trickier orbitals to draw. When you have two nodes in a cyclic system, they must be 90 degrees to each other. So there's two possibilities here. One of the two nodes passes through atoms, or neither of the two nodes passes through atoms. And it will help if you can remember some of this about how many nodes are out. 0, 1, 2, 3. And in the two-node case, remembering that they have to be at 90 degrees to each other. So the one where it passes through, I'm again going to gently erase to show that it's not used. And then notice that we have just antibonding interactions left. Or I got to stop using that word antibonding, because within an orbital, there is not bonding and antibonding. There's constructive and deconstructive interference. So we just have only unfavorable interactions. The other side, we have both favorable and unfavorable interactions, but the favorable is going to be outnumbered by the unfavorable. So we have two favorable interactions, but 1, 2, 3, 4 unfavorable ones. And then we already know that the top one is just all unfavorable, so it is the highest energy orbital. Now, how many pi electrons in benzene?
Six.
Notice they all only go into bonding orbitals. So this is already one difference from the cyclobutadiene case. What we haven't seen in this diagram, what we could see once we discuss it a little further, is the fact that these electrons are lower in energy than if we had three independent pi bonds. So if you think about it, a moment ago I looked at cyclobutadiene and I said, well, what if we had just two independent double bonds? Well, there all the electrons are just in bonding orbitals. And so I said that that's why cyclobutadiene is bad, because you end up with two bonding electrons versus four. Benzene has six bonding electrons. Three individual double bonds have bonding electrons. So there's one additional argument we have to make, that in the individual double bonds, you'll never get as good an overlap like what we've got here in the lowest energy level of benzene. So the benzene's lowest energy level is lower than the bond of a pi bond. And so overall,
this will be the argument I wrap up on Thursday. This system is lower in energy than you could ever get from individual pi-bonds. And that's why benzene is aromatic, because we end up with this very unusual stability. To take this further, there's that device I talked about earlier that we're going to use to predict energy levels. That's called a Frost circle, if any of you have ever heard that in any of your other classes. If any of you have had any aromatic chemistry before, you might have heard of the Huckel rules. The Huckel rules for predicting when will something be aromatic, when will something have this stabilization. And I'll just rattle them off. I'm doing this out loud now because we don't have the time to do it properly. But for aromaticity, something has to be cyclic. It is the cyclization of the system that causes that unusual stability. On top of that, it has to be planar, because if the p orbitals don't overlap, even if it's cyclic, you wouldn't have interaction. So it has to be cyclic, planar. All of the p orbitals, or every atom in that system at least, that's in the ring, has to be conjugated. And then the last one of these rules is what's called the 4n plus 2 rule. It's a rule you'll see a lot. What I've shown us is the groundwork for proving why is it this 4n plus 2 is the magic number of electrons we must have. And so discussing more about example molecules that are aromatic, or talking about what is aromaticity, or this set of rules, that's what we're going to finish with on Thursday.